Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Welcome back to another episode of Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Steph, and this week I'm joined by the whole team. So Pat, Teresa, Linda, Heather and Nicola.
Hello.
Hi.
We've got a packed show again. Pat is going to read from her work in progress, and then Teresa is going to give us her word of the week. Our main feature today will be a discussion on genre fiction, what it is, and how do you tell when it crosses over. And we're going to take a deeper dive into two specific types of genre fiction, using Nicola and Linda's work as case studies to explore some of the codes and conventions around specific genres. And then Linda and Teresa are going to tell us what's on their bedside table. But first, Heather, will you please ask us to
name the novel?
I certainly will. And as a clue within a clue, the first line of this novel, to get there, you follow Highway 58, going northeast out of the city. And it's a good highway, and new.
Not yet.
It's somewhere in America.
That's right.
Clue two. This author was born in Guthrie, Kentucky, in 1905 and died in September 1989. During a prolific writing career, he was a renowned supporter of racial integration. In 1965, he published Who Speaks for the Negro, a collection of interviews with black civil rights leaders, including Malcolm X and Martin Luther King.
No clue. Vague. Well, I've got an idea that's very, very vague.
I had one, but I'm not sure now.
Okay, clue three. This novel won the Pulitzer Prize in 1947. It became a highly successful film, winning an Academy Award for Best Picture in 1949. A further film adaptation was made in 2006 with Sean Penn and Jude Law. And the opera Willie Stark by Carlisle Floyd was first performed in 1981.
Good God.
Sounds like we all should know this one.
I have no idea.
Yeah. I was thinking James Baldwin goes on the mountain.
But the film just ruined
that thinking.
Well, I was thinking about Angie, but
perhaps. You know, A Raisin in the Sun was much later. Yeah. It was the 60s, the film.
But and, that was remade. It was remade and with Sean Penn and Jude Law.
Absolutely no idea. No, completely flummoxed.
I'm going to feel really stupid.
Kevin, have you got it? Because we haven't.
Okay, it's All the King's Men by Robert Penn.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
I've never heard of it.
All the King's Men. I just didn't think that I didn't. I thought about that, but I didn't think the first line was about, you know, going down the road on 58.
Now, darn it. The reason, one of the reasons that made me think about it is Linda's husband, Hal, recommended it to us as a read for while we were in New Orleans, because that's where it's about.
Right.
And did you read it?
I've read some of it. I've not read all of it yet.
Yeah. Well,
that very good.
Well done.
Got us. Absolutely got us.
Good. Right, well, let's go to something a bit more relaxing.
Shall we? I'm so upset.
So you've got the beginning of a story for us from your Greek village.
Yeah.
Over to you.
Okay. At the moment, it's called Maggie, because that's the central character. It's a truth universally acknowledged that all holiday reps hate transfer day, she declared as she stood waiting for the delayed flight to arrive. It was clear from the blank expressions on the faces of the other reps that Jane Austen did not feature on their reading lists. In fact, thought Maggie, looking around as she fanned herself with a clipboard, I'd be surprised if some of these ever picked up anything more intellectually demanding than Hello Magazine. In her 50s, she was far and away the oldest of the reps. She'd been doing the job and loving it for almost 30 years and had seen dozens of younger ones come and go. These days, most of them look like teenagers. And that, my girl, is a sign that you're getting old, she told herself. So far, she'd resisted head office's offers of a training position back in the UK, even though it would mean more money. She'd argued that if she didn't cover Seagree, who would? It was so remote that it needed someone with experience who could handle things if there was an emergency. Maggie tended to think most of the younger ones would have problems organising their own sock drawers, never mind managing some of the situations she'd coped with over the years. Plus, most of the visitors were either families with children or older couples. They feel more comfortable with a reliable old biddy like me, you know they do. They don't want a Darren or a Sasha, all bleach blonde highlights and cheeky cocktails. And the youngsters certainly don't want to be stuck out in Seagree, missing out on all the action. They'd be going AWOL every 5 minutes. And because they knew she was right, and because she had the consistent 5-star customer reviews that proved just how valuable an asset she was to them, they'd kept her there. But now, things were about to change. The company had decided to drop Seagree from their brochure. The bean counters had decided that the number of visitors choosing to go there just weren't enough to make it economically viable any longer. In truth, there were still almost as many visitors to the village as there ever had been. But most of them now were long-standing returnees who booked their own flights and accommodation. The brochure now would only offer the much livelier resorts on the other side of the island. As for Maggie, the training position was still on offer. And while her head told her that that was the sensible thing to do, her heart said otherwise. Greece had effectively been her home for over 20 years, since she'd started work as a tour rep in her early 20s and fell in love with the country. She'd worked on most of the popular islands during the holiday season, but come October, when the resorts closed down, instead of taking the last flights home as most of the others did, to spend the winters with family, finding jobs to tide them over till the following year, she'd gone exploring.
Thank you. Nicola? Mm.
Oh, I loved it. I just love the way you're just conjuring up all these people who are so disparate, but who've got this basic love of Greece. And I just wanted to keep reading. I felt cheated that it finished so soon.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. I particularly enjoyed the cheeky cocktails line. Yeah. That was just brilliant.
We all like a cheeky cocktail. We do. Right.
Oh, I know, but I remember having a tour at once, and every word was cheekiness and cheeky cocktails.
Yeah.
I just wanted to throttle him.
You're such an observer of people. The fact that you know, you bring that, you've noticed that, and you bring that out.
And that they're all called Sasha and Darren.
Yeah. Sorry to all the Sasha and Darren.
Yeah, sorry. Or if anybody's got any children, they've named Sasha or Darren. Yeah. They don't necessarily have to be holiday
rooms. That's right.
With bleach blonde highlights.
Mm. How about you, Linda?
Well, I enjoyed it too. You know, I said, I hope she knows where it's going to take us, because I'm very curious about what's going to happen to her next.
What she does in the winter.
Right. And Pat, I think, are you going to kill her?
No. No, I'm not going to kill her.
Oh, so she's going to be a murderer.
I want to know about her love life.
I think.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. I've got something to say about that.
I don't think there are going to be any deaths in this.
Oh,
one.
Good. Oh, my goodness.
At the moment.
Yeah.
Actually, things change.
The deaths that you've done in the past have been very interesting. So, no, my one comment was that I don't really feel that I know her well yet. I've been trying to visualize what she looks like and stuff, and I haven't quite gotten there. So that was my only thing I wanted to know more about. Well, I want to know where it goes, but I wanted to know more now about how to visualize her.
Okay.
I take it she's not a bleach blonde.
I think she probably is.
She's down here. She's saying they don't want bleach blonde and stuff.
Highlights.
Like that.
Bleach blonde highlights. Oh, okay. Different to being bleach blonde.
Okay.
Teresa, how about you?
Yeah, I thought this was an absolutely great start. I love the character. When you start out with, you know, the first paragraph, quoting Pride and Prejudice and saying the other reps didn't read Jane Austen, you've set her apart. You've given us a good idea of her character, a little bit condescending, maybe a little bit of a snob or whatever. Just given us a strong sense of her character. And when she says that they they'd have trouble organising their own sock drawers. Again, that says something about her, doesn't it? I mean, you know, but she's got a sock drawer.
She's got a sock drawer, and they probably haven't got
organised by colour, colour and tone.
They probably haven't got socks. The Downton
Yeah,
They might have.
It's
knickers.
An expression rather than a.
Yes,
yeah.
I know.
Not sure she actually does have. A sock drawer.
as ever, struggling to find things to critique. But I wonder, depending on how long the story is. When you say they'd have trouble organising their own sock drawer, never mind managing some of the situations you'd cope with over the years, are you going to give us some examples of those situations?
I
think that would be nice, and see how she's dealt with things. I did wonder about the use of the word biddy. You know, even in a self-deprecating way, she's in her 50s. Is she really thinking of herself as an old biddy?
That's young.
Well, you know, my mum's in her 90s and she talks about old ladies like, you know, they're old ladies' trousers, I'm not wearing those. So, you know, I just wonder at what point you think of yourself in that category. However, as I say, I'm struggling here. I did wonder in that paragraph, when she's justifying all the reasons why she should be in that job, as opposed to these younger people, where you say they'd be going AWOL every 5 minutes, you could almost have a paragraph break and then on its own, and because they knew she was right, and because she had the consistent 5-star customer reviews, that proved her point, if you like. The only other thing towards the end, the last paragraph, Greece had effectively been her home for over 20 years, since she'd started work and fell in love and fallen in love. She'd started work and fallen in love. She'd started work and fell. I just thought fell wasn't quite right, but I could be wrong. But I like it. I want to know where it's going. But I did think she's been in Greece a long time. There's going to be one or two Greek boyfriends along the way that she's encountered. Yeah. So maybe we'll get a little flashback. Or maybe she's involved with somebody now. Interested, intrigued.
I like the idea of the sock drawer. For me, that it helped give me a picture in my head of who she was, and I could imagine a person very precise, you know, that would, you know, have everything in order, and everything be, you know, in straight lines, and all, you know, all the clothes on the hangers.
Exactly,
in the
I think
same
that's
way.
What I was that getting was, at. Too. Yes, it gives you
that,
insight.
That was that, and I could see her being that person, and probably treating the younger people with disdain.
And when they're coming into the office with the hangovers and their tales of what they've got up to the night before,
and she'd maybe be the kind of person that maybe have a, you know, a sweet sherry at Christmas.
Yeah, I'm definitely getting the sense now we're talking that something's going to come that was going to upset her finely tuned life. Perhaps someone's going to come back into her life.
I feel that she's a little bit more sophisticated than a sherry at Christmas.
Yes, and she's quite adventurous.
I think she's adventurous,
she?
And she's been there and done that. I think you're right about the boyfriends.
Yeah.
I love it. I love her wry humour. I love the Hello magazine reference, the tidying the sock drawer. The opening sets it up brilliantly. Yeah. I love all that. My only question is about the point of view slip when, and because they knew she was right and because she had the consistent 5-star reviews, they had kept her there. Now, that is her belief.
So
I would just wonder if, I agree with Teresa about making that a separate paragraph and just have them, and she was sure that they knew she was right. And it was because of her consistent 5-star customer reviews that they kept her there. So just to, because otherwise you're kind of, you're telling us,
swapping us into the company's
point of view almost. I know that.
Oh, you're so good at picking those up.
Well, it's only such a tiny thing because actually you could read it that it's her in a dialogue anyway. Well, they know I'm right.
Yeah.
That's really the only thing I could find to comment on. You see, I'm really.
But it's difficult.
Going back to the character of it, I'm really looking forward to being completely wrong about it. For me, I like the idea that I've got in my head of this person that's going to be possibly nothing at all like that first impression.
Isn't it wonderful when you get your expectations completely subverted?
Yes, I love it.
So she's a pole dancer in a part-time. Yeah. In the winter. Yeah. Something like that.
Anyway, 12 children on a sheep farm up in the hills.
Here's my notes.
Thank you.
Here are mine. But Heather, may I ask you what does she look like for you? Do you have a physical appearance for her yet?
Yes, I imagined her to be quite small, very slim, with very neat, very
efficient looking. Yeah, I got neat as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know what I had? I really don't have, or maybe I just don't like my image and I want another one. But I think of her as a stocky kind of person that has that half gray, half black hair. She's turning pretty gray. And she wears red lipstick and she wears hosiery that's kind of, doesn't have a seam up the back, but she's kind of a bit, the younger ones don't wear hosiery and stuff, I don't think.
Well, I'm not sure now, but it used to be there were quite strict rules for reps, especially when they go to the airport. Mm. And I think sometimes they had to wear tights even in a cold climate.
Even today, I spoke to a holiday rep a year ago, and she was saying that she didn't like airport days because she had to wear court shoes. She wasn't allowed to wear sandals. Yeah. Whereas in resort, they're allowed to wear sandals. And that was a year ago.
And certainly a friend of mine who was a rep up until about 10 years ago said on airport days, absolute minimum lipstick and eyeshadow.
Oh, really?
Wow. You were supposed to wear makeup. And, you know, even if you're not a person who wears makeup, that was expected.
But I think Maggie does wear makeup. And I think her hair is bouffanted. I think she has a perm or something every so often, or it's got a natural wave. And I think she's got red nails, and I think she has her toenails painted regularly.
And red lipstick.
She's waxed.
She's waxed. Polished.
I think she's a very capable, independent woman.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, Stephanie, what are court shoes? Did you say C-O-U-R-T?
Pumps. You call them pumps.
They're low-heeled, kitten-heeled shoes that are enclosed, so you can't see your toes.
Okay. Why are they called court shoes?
Well, presumably, if you were presented at court, you had to have decent footwear and not show your toes and not wearing sandals.
We were presented at court until the 1950s, Lynn.
Oh, really? Okay.
That was the minor crime.
Well, maybe it is for court appearances. Maybe I've got
If anybody
wrong.
Knows what court, where the court shoe court expression shoes. Came from, well, maybe it's a Britishism.
Well, I wonder. I don't think in America they're going to call anything like that.
No, they call them pumps.
Right, moving on. Thank you, Pat.
Well, thank you.
Now, Teresa, you've got a word of the week for us.
Well, I've got a bog off, actually. Buy one, get one free, because I've got two words. I was musing, as you do, on the words boho and hobo and whether they're related. So I looked into it a little bit. So boho we use to describe a certain style, a kind of free and easy, hippie-ish style of dress often. And as you'd expect, it's abbreviated from bohemian.
Mm-hmm.
And the original meaning of bohemian, and still a current meaning, obviously, is a native or inhabitant of Bohemia, which is in the Czech Republic. But the word bohemian, when not capitalised, has come to mean a vagabond, a wanderer, especially, or a gypsy, or a person, such as a writer or an artist, living an unconventional life, usually or often in a colony with others. A bit like us, really. So we're boho, we're bohemian. So Etymology Online gives bohemian as a gypsy, a person, an artist living a free and somewhat dissipated life, despising conventionalities and having little regard for social standards. It came to have that meaning around 1848 from a transferred sense of French bohémienne, a bohemian meaning a gypsy. From the country name Bohemia or the region Bohemia, there was some confusion that gypsies came from Bohemia. That's where that's come from. So the French used bohémienne since the 15th century to mean gypsy, since they believed that the Roma came from Bohemia, perhaps because that's the direction they took when they first came into Western Europe, or because they were confused with the 15th century Bohemian Hussite heretics who were driven from their country about the same time. So they were on the move at the same time as the Roma, so maybe they got mixed up. The transferred sense in reference to unconventional living is attested in French by 1834 and was popularised by Henri Murger's stories from the late 1840s, which were collected as Scenes de la Vie de Bohème. And this was the basis of Puccini's opera, La Bohème. And it first appears, bohemian, in English in 1848 in Thackeray's Vanity Fair.
Oh.
Yeah, who knew? So it's become very commonly accepted in our day as the description of a certain kind of literary gypsy, mm-hmm. no matter what language he or she speaks or where they live. A bohemian is simply an artist or litterateur who consciously or unconsciously secedes from conventionality in life and in art. So it can be used in an adjectival sense as well as unconventional, free from social restraints. And that's where we get boho, which is the style thing, if you're, mm. you know, unconventional in dress. So hobo means a migratory worker, a homeless, usually penniless vagabond, a tramp. In 1889, this sense appears in the Western US, hobo meaning a tramp, but the origins are unknown. It has been compared to the early 19th century English dialect word hawbuck, which apparently means a lout, a clumsy fellow, a country bumpkin. Or possibly from hoboy, a worker's call in late 19th century Western US railroads. Okay, mm-hmm. And possibly the facetious formation hobohemia is the community or life of hobos from 1923. So they did come together sort of in 1923. Hobohemia was, if you like, the wonderful life of a hobo on the roads. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's interesting that's 1923 mm-hmm. when that was this sort of between the wars, the great era of caravanning and the idealisation and glamorisation of the sort of gypsy lifestyle mm. that comes.
I've always thought of a hobo as an American expression.
Mm. Yeah. I think it is. We use tramp. We would use tramp.
Really?
Or travelling man.
Traveller.
Mm. Traveller.
Yeah. Well, the traveller's more...
That's
gypsy,
a different culture, isn't it? Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. Mainly Irish travellers.
Well, Jack Reacher's character would be a hobo now, wouldn't he?
Would he be a boho hobo?
I don't know.
A hobohemian.
He's a military hobo, so that's a different thing again.
Yeah, I don't hear the term hobo in the United States anymore. When I was a child, people talked a lot about it, and I was in Texas then. Yeah. People talked a lot about hobos. Maybe it's because we live near the train tracks, and they would... come on and come off and come to your door for, you know, asking.
But society's changed a lot as well. Yeah. So maybe that doesn't exist so more where people travelled for work with nothing but what they could carry and tramped. And that's where we get tramped from, because people tramped. Yeah. And even in the 1930s in England, I read, it was a factual account of a true crime. Mm. But one of the witnesses was a woman with a pram. This is in Northumberland, who was walking from Scotland with her baby in a pram, looking for work. And people did. They just got out there. And so it doesn't quite exist anymore,
right,
I suspect.
Not the same.
Not the same. Mm. No.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that. Now, as promised, we're going to explore genre in fiction. So do you know what genre you're writing in? Some writers know the genre they want to write in before they start, and others work it out once they've finished. So let's start with the word genre. It originates in the 19th century in French, and it literally means a kind or a sort. The Collins Dictionary definition says genre is a particular type of literature, painting, music, film, or other art form which people consider as a class because it has its own special characteristics. The Oxford English Dictionary says it's a style or category of art, music, or literature. And Merriam-Webster says it's a category of artistical, musical, or literary composition characterised by a particular style, form, or content. So other words would be type, group, school, form. Okay. So why do we need to talk about genre? We had this last week, didn't we, Heather? You said, I don't really care what the genre is. If I like it, I like it. Mm-hmm. Well, as we discussed briefly then, it helps the reader to decide whether or not they want to read it. And agents and publishers tend to have their preferences on the kind of books they publish. So being able to say what genre your book or your work falls into is a way of telling people what to expect from it, because every genre has its own codes and conventions.
And also, in terms of agents and publishers, you're wasting your time sending your book to people who don't publish that style of thing.
If they don't do sci-fi, don't submit to them. Mm-hmm. That's why it's important to know. And those codes and conventions cover setting, characters, and plots. So, for example, just take this for an example, a Gothic horror. It's often given a dark setting, like a forest or a medieval building or a wild, untamed landscape where the weather is grim or gloomy or cloudy or it's dark. Gothic heroes are often people who have been ostracised from normal society for some reason. And women in Gothic horrors tend to be victims. And the antagonist is generally quite menacing. He evokes, or she evokes, or you feel scared of them. And Gothic plots often have a curse or an ancient prophecy or a family secret or some sort of mystery to overcome. And other conventions in Gothic horrors might be supernatural characters. There's often torture, suicide, murder, real danger, you know, that kind of thing. So you get the picture. Mm. And that isn't to say this is a Gothic novel because it's set in an ancient castle, because the reader expects that whole package of things. And that's what we really mean by codes and conventions. So we wanted to look at particular codes and conventions of specific genres. And we thought, what better way to do it than to use some real live examples? So Linda, for example, we would say is probably writing a coming-of-age novel or a rite-of-passage novel about Mary Magdalene. So Linda, can you tell us some of the key points of setting, character and plot which makes Mary Magdalene's story a coming-of-age novel?
Right. Well, Mary Magdalene, I set her in West Virginia in the 1950s in a little place called Pawpaw. It's a small village. It's poor. I needed her to be coming from a rather unsophisticated kind of place and background, because what she wants, her journey that she's seeking and the change that will happen comes about from her being naive, rather selfish about what she's wanting to get, to going to understanding and accepting things that right now she feels are all there is, you know, that's the bee's knees or whatever. And she will come to understand that there are truer values and priorities elsewhere, and she will become more worldly in her views and less confined to just what I want and things that I think are glamorous, because she's going to Little Rock that she thinks is a very glamorous place. And so that would be then the reason the settings are this way. And then as far as the characters go, we have the focus on Mary Magdalene and her father, Eli. She's 11 years old, and he's her father, and they're going on a road trip together. But because she's in this young state, then at this age, it's very nicely set so that she can realize a more grown-up kind of view as we go along.
So the journey itself is her journey. It's a physical journey as a metaphor for her own internal journey.
Right. It's a road trip, but she's going to be traveling from one psychological state to another.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. So that's lovely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And did you know all this before you started, or has it grown up as it went along?
I knew that she would change. Because I had the end in mind where she discovers, you know, that things are not as she had thought they would be or whatever. And she comes to a greater understanding of what's important. So, yeah.
So Goodreads has a definition of coming of age.
Right.
And I thought it would be worth looking at that and comparing it to what you've just said.
Yeah.
Because we've talked as well about crossover. Because there's so many, you can slice genres so many different ways. So Goodreads say a coming-of-age story is a genre of literature that focuses on the growth of a protagonist from youth to adulthood. Okay. In this instance, you've slightly subverted that because it's from childhood to teenagehood. It's puberty that you're looking at here rather than directly to adulthood.
Right.
I don't think that matters in terms.
I don't think so. I think what matters is that there is the change, the psychological
growth, isn't it? Now, coming-of-age stories, again, this is Goodreads, coming-of-age stories tend to emphasise dialogue or internal monologue over action and are often set in the past or have adults looking back in the past.
Mm-hmm. I think if you listen to my Mary Magdalene, you'll see that it's almost all dialogue.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that really rung true with me when I was looking at this. Now, Here's another thing where you're subverting some of the expectations. The subjects of coming-of-age stories are typically males in their mid-teens, although sometimes there are females. But you've actually got a female in her
preteens.
Mm-hmm. But that's great because they're about as mature as boys in their mid-teens, aren't they? But the themes of maturation, acculturation, loss of innocence, wisdom and or acumen and worldliness are often present. I mean, there's that in spades, I think.
Right, yeah.
I think that's what yours is.
But
you could take the same story and you could say it's a quest.
That's right. Right. The hero's journey.
Yeah.
But then there are different things you'd have to include to make it satisfying for the reader.
Well, that's why it's important to tell the reader what they're going to get. But you could say this is a coming of age quest.
It's also is it a, do you think it would be a kind of redemption story? I don't know if it's going to go that far, but
I've been doing a lot of studying about this because I knew absolutely nothing about it. But you said something really interesting several times now, the subversion of the genre.
Well, that's what makes work interesting.
That's what makes good work writing stand good. Out rather than writing in a formulaic genre.
Exactly what goes through my mind, that if you stick to the conventions or whatever rigidly, then it just
becomes. And this is why I write and then I work out what genre it fits into afterwards. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, and I quite often when you see a book that says this book meets this book, then I'll get excited if I liked both of the books, you know.
Yeah, they're complicated.
But to know the genre and conventions is, I think, a good thing
for
when you need to go then and start pitching your book to other people.
Yes.
Now, I know, Nicola, you like to work from knowing what they are before you start.
Well, just because I didn't know anything about writing at all. I know that you guys probably knew it, but I didn't, and you didn't know that I didn't, so I've been doing my own sort of studying, trying to become better, and I found it very helpful to know that certain genres have certain pre-required scenes and conventions, because that helps, within the three-act structure, that helped me plot where scenes should go.
Mm-hmm. So you were telling us that you were writing science fiction, and then...
Yes.
And then you wondered if it might involve some supernatural fantasy, so that became a sort of cross-genre book. And now you feel that your story is more action-adventure.
It's really interesting, and I've lost interest in it as it's changed.
Right, okay. Well, can you talk us through those conclusions?
Yes.
Why you thought you were writing science fiction to start with, why you then thought you needed supernatural fantasy, then how you came to action-adventure. Okay.
Well, science fiction is my favourite genre. I quite like fantasy as well, you know, Game of Thrones, obviously a particular example, but generally speaking, I'm drawn to sci-fi, and I didn't know that there were certain conventions of sci-fi, and some of them are, you know, we're not in Kansas anymore, so we must learn early on this universe differs from ours. Well, Brienne dies and ends up in a different place, so I'm still there. Rules of the universe, it must have insights into how the magic or the tech works. And then the other thing is that the magic or the tech has a price. There must be limitations and consequences of using it. And then the magic or the tech makes trouble. It must shape the character and society, and magic aids the hero. The magic or the tech must aid the hero.
What do you mean by magic?
Mm. Well, magic, if it's a fantasy, it's more likely to be magic that's driving the story. And if it's a sci-fi...
Science fiction, there's no magic.
No, you can't... Exactly. But I've noticed that a lot of books I've been reading recently have actually been blurring the two. So, you know, there is sometimes magic and tech in a book. So I think that convention is blurring.
So what you're saying is sci-fi, the conventions of sci-fi, pure sci-fi, are...
Tech.
That it's scientific.
Yes. Mm. It should at least be not far away from what's possible now.
Yeah.
That's the best sci-fi.
Right, that's a great...
That it could be imaginable from the tech we have now.
Yeah.
So in 10 years or so, when the roads are full of driverless cars... We can imagine other technology evolving from that, like pilotless planes or so on.
And it's really interesting how much of the tech from sci-fi, early sci-fi in the 40s and 50s now is commonplace, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, when you think about Star Trek, you know, and the
communicators.
Things? Communicators. Yeah. I mean, it's like our mobile phones. It's incredible. Yeah. And you know, there's things where you're drawing in the sky on a glass screen. Mm. I mean, you see that all the time in real life now.
Mm. So that makes it science fiction.
Yeah, or fantasy.
Right. If it's magic, therefore couldn't be true. If it's science fiction, then it could be true.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Very good. And I'd like to add a few because, you know, I read a lot of sci-fi and I think there's got to be a big chase across the galaxy against time.
I wouldn't agree with that because if you take...
A sci-fi could be set in a nuclear reactor. It's not necessarily no, in the galaxy.
If you look at one of them, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, there's no chase across the galaxy, and that's one of the most classic science fiction books of all time.
Yeah,
There's
no, I mean,
there's no
you're talking about space.
Yeah,
which space opera. Yes, yeah, space opera, perhaps I'm talking about. So there are subgenres now within science fiction.
Of course,
And there seems to be a lot, I read, you know, a lot of new science fiction. There seems to be a lot about, you know, mankind killing the planet or the universe and ruining their surroundings and things like that. And then the other thing that seems to be cropping up a lot now is artificial intelligences that generally have a humorous twist, though they have personalities, which is becoming very popular. So then I thought, okay, well, my book isn't any of these, really. And then I thought, and okay, so she dies and wakes up again, so does that make it a supernatural thriller? And then I thought, well, what does thriller mean? Well, thriller is an action adventure with elements of a supernatural or a horror overtone. So you can have an action story, like think Die Hard, Bruce Willis, classic action story, not very deep in no inner maturation plot, really. He doesn't change at all throughout the book.
Lots of crash cars.
Yeah, lots of crash cars, exactly. So they, you know, that's the I've got some conventions here. And then you can have an adventure, which tends to be more of a quest. But then you can combine the two, action-adventure, which is a quest with lots of action. And if it's got horror, you know, elements of horror where it's graphic violence or graphic things happening to people, it becomes an action-adventure thriller. So it does all get very confusing, but there it does give you a place to start. So, and I was thinking, okay, so action adventure, that's what I'll do then. Hero, victim, villain. Got to have three main characters, and they've all got to be very clear. There's got to be a destination and a promise. There's got to be a path or a methodology, and that's often where you get a mentor coming in. There's got to be a sidekick. There's got to be set pieces and way stations. So there are mini what it means is set pieces are like mini stories within the global story. And then you've always got to have a hero at the mercy of the villain scene. And generally speaking, there's some sort of scene where the villain gets praised by not the hero necessarily, but perhaps the hero's sidekick. So you've got to believe that the villain is clever and almost impossible to outwit.
So in your Brienne story, is it clear who's the hero? Who's
no,
the victim,
I haven't got a villain yet. I haven't got a villain yet. Well, I sort of have, but I haven't written any of the parts yet.
And is Brienne the victim or the hero?
Well, she's supposed to be the heroine, but I want her to be a bit of an anti-heroine because I think it's a little bit anodyne just to have someone who's a clear out. I don't think anyone who's done what Brienne's done can be a hero, so she's got to be a bit of an anti-hero. But then the internal genre is going to be a redemption, which often goes with the action-adventure genre. There's a redemption of a character. Obviously, Bruce Willis didn't change at all, so that was why it was more action than adventure, because the quest, if it's a quest on an adventure, it should change the character.
But I wonder if the writer knew that, the writer of Die Hard, I wonder if they knew that before they started writing, or if they wrote the story and then decided where it fitted in order to try and sell it. I think that's what we're getting at.
I think in Hollywood you've got to be able to sell your picture. You have to be able to capture people's imagination very quickly. So
And the same with your elevator pitch for your book or your 15-second pitch. That's why you have to be able to say when you're writing to an agent, this is historical fiction that explores themes of, or this is science fiction that explores themes of. You know, they want to know the genre and the kind of themes. And if you are going to have something that crosses genre, that's going to be something you've got to understand really well, I guess.
And you've really got to be explicit about it, I suppose. Because if you pitch it as a particular genre or crossover of genres, and then they can't find the stuff that they're expecting, so the conventions, then you're not going to be happy.
And that, you know, that was interesting for me as a new writer, because thinking about, okay, well, how are you ever going to write anything that's different? If you're adhering to conventions, and a lot of people won't want to get involved in this, but as I read on, I found out that, as you were saying, the subversion of the conventions of a genre are what makes books really interesting. But how to do that in an interesting, different way? That's the challenge of a good writer.
But understanding the conventions of the genre is really important before you start to subvert them, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Like, you know, you can't be a good modern painter without knowing how to paint in the first place. And I've just found it really, really interesting. And the reassuring that there are these architectural things in the book that underpin it all.
Yeah.
definitely made it easier to get going.
Well, certainly, as I say, when you have a thing completed, and then you come to genres like historical fiction, let's say,
isn't really a genre at all.
No. Because within historical fiction, as within sci-fi, you can have a science fiction story that's coming of age, or an action adventure set in the historical fiction, or a war story set in history, just as you can have a science fiction story that deals with coming of age.
The other thing I found particularly interesting is that people feel very satisfied with books where the internal genre and the external genre cross each other at the points of the end of the first act and the end of the second act. So
tell us what you mean by
internal. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, so for example,
so it might be that we use different terminology.
Yeah. Think Clarice Starling in Silence of the Lambs when she starts to get included in the FBI investigation, but at the same time as the external plot is taking a nosedive because they're finding more bodies. And apparently if you can cross those things over, positive and negative, internal and external, at certain points in the story, the first act and the end of the second act, then that makes for greater reader satisfaction.
That's the turning point. What the three-act structure would call that is the turning point at the end of the first act.
So but if you can get an internal turn and an external turn at roughly the same point.
I think I found, as I said last week, that the more I read, in a way, the more confused I became, because there's this genre, then there's a sub-genre for this.
Right.
But then where does something that's innovative and new and exciting, but that doesn't actually fit into one of these little boxes, where does that
that's
go?
That's called genre busting.
So something Nicola said a few weeks ago made me realise that I do need to be more specific. So I hadn't looked at any of this stuff, but Nicola told us, you know, that the villain must appear quite early on, and, you know, the victim, the hero should be at the mercy of the villain at some point. And that's definitely influenced how I've changed Drunella.
Well, I think it's helping us root for the hero, isn't it? If you don't know who which I haven't got in mind, if you don't know who the villain is, you can't be rooting for the hero against the villain. You need a sense of who.
So that's what you're saying, you don't have a villain
yet? Well, I do in my head, but I haven't brought them out yet. So perhaps that's what I need to do. I mean, I sort of know who it needs to be in.
And the paramedic.
The paramedic, who shall never be heard from again.
Right. So what you're saying is, in an action adventure story, or a thriller, the villain and the hero, the protagonist and the antagonist, need to both be known early on.
Well, we need to know who they are. We don't necessarily need to meet them. They don't need to meet each other, but we need to know who we're fighting against.
Yeah.
In a crime story, it's always the murderer, isn't it, is the villain, and they're very swiftly introduced by way of a murder.
Yeah.
So you know who it is, even if the hero hasn't met
the villain. That's good.
And they may not actually be revealed until right at the end. At the end they're revealed.
And in a political thriller, it might be somebody trying to change something in the opposition party, but that will focus on one person rather than the whole political party. Yeah, I get you.
And the whole thriller thing, you know, that's just graphic violence and detail overlaid over a science fiction or an action adventure or whatever. So if we're adding the words thriller, it means there's an element of graphic horror to it.
Yes, and I would understand that. If I picked up a book and it said this is a supernatural thriller, I would put it down. Because I know that I don't want to know about things that don't really exist.
Right, that might hurt you badly.
And and I don't want to read about explicit gore and violence. So that, to me, is where, as a reader, the genre
it's becomes... It's helpful.
Well, the genre is important.
Yeah.
If it says it's an erotic thriller, equally I'd put it down. But if it said it was a psychological thriller, I'd keep it.
See, I'd be less likely to read a psychological thriller because I don't want people playing with my mind, but I'm quite happy to deal with the
sex and the violence.
Bring it on.
This is why we need to understand genre and what those genre codes and conventions are.
And I had a very interesting experience when I was away, because a little girl of 11 had written a book, and, you know, I'm not saying whether it was any good or not, but she'd written a book that I immediately recognised should be lit RPG, which was had come from
What does lit RPG mean?
Literature that's about a role-playing game. Mm-hmm. And it's a brand new category. And I thought, as soon as I heard her talking about her story, I thought, oh, it's a lit RPG. I wonder if she's got it in.
So is it like fan lit, a sort of spin off from the game?
It's where all the action happens within a role playing game,
right.
Either on a computer or in imagination.
Wow.
I know, well, I only happen to know that because I've been listening to some stuff and the guy's writing a lit RPG. And when I heard that, you know, this little girl had put her book onto Amazon, self published. I was really impressed for a start. But then I wanted to know which categories had she put it in.
Mm-hmm.
And actually it turns out that you can't choose your genre on Amazon. You have to choose categories that you're in as dictated by Amazon. So she was in science fiction general. And actually she should have been in young adult science fiction because that was more specific. The more specific you can get on Amazon, the better. But what we did do was weave the words lit RPG action adventure into her title,
mm-hmm.
so that if anyone searched lit RPG, mm-hmm. her book would come up.
Right.
So there's a difference on Amazon between the categories they choose for you and your genres. They don't work in genres on Amazon, they work in categories.
Right.
So it's important to know what your category is as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, it is, yeah. And the best way to do that is go and look at some books that you think are in a similar vein to yours and see where Amazon's.
And that's great advice when you're writing to agents or publishers. Mm-hmm. You say, I think this book would be enjoyed by people who enjoyed these books and make a comparison. That's not to say my book's as good as these books or better than these books, but it's just...
Or a copy of.
Yeah, it just gives the agent or the publisher the idea that is where the book fits, and therefore they'll know what they know.
And you get three categories on Amazon, and my publisher, because I'm self-published and I have a publisher on my business side, my publisher says they can't influence the categories. That's hence my book going to number one in management, accounting and audit and auditing. You know, I wouldn't have chosen those, but my publisher says they've got no control over it. Amazon algorithm decides where you're best placed. Which is frightening.
So, Heather, you said you don't take any notice of genres. So if you picked up a book that said thriller supernatural, would you put it down or keep it?
No, the only thing personally I don't like would be anything with extreme violence or there are authors that, you know, they're very descriptive of, you know, the blood and the gore and everything else, and I wouldn't want those. I just feel as though it's all very controlling. Mm. I want to be able to read something that breaks the mould, that introduces somebody who's exciting and, you know, sort of writing a story that I've never thought about, and or even, you know, inventing worlds that in their own head and things like that, rather than sticking to sort of very rigid stereotypes.
Yeah, I don't think when we're talking about genre, we're necessarily talking about sticking rigidly. No. Or about stereotypes. Mm. So that's another thing, isn't it? But, you know, I take your point, and many of our listeners will be saying, I'm just writing what I'm writing and it's entirely original and I'm not interested in knowing about these rules or supposed conventions, which is fine. Just,
I think as a reader who then becomes a writer, which most of us are trying to do, without reading about it all, as Nicola's done, you've absorbed the conventions.
Yes.
Right.
You've absorbed the conventions of narrative, you've absorbed the conventions of particular genres, and whatever it is that you're writing, those conventions are not necessarily a straitjacket, they're just a framework.
That's how I think of them, as a framework.
Rather than
you were saying about the guy who'd written High Fidelity. He went away and he stopped writing and went away because he hadn't read enough. Did you say that?
Yeah,
I picked up on that because that was interesting. He just felt he hadn't read enough to be a good writer. I think you're right. It's exactly what you're saying, isn't it?
And I think in all the lists we've done recently about self-care and, you know, looking after writers, I think every person we've interviewed or spoken to or read about reads. To read as much as you possibly can, because you're right, then you do absorb all of those things about how that works, that doesn't work. So,
and you know what kind of books you like.
Yes,
and you know that, you know, if you read a Leanne Moriarty book, you know the kind of story you're going to get. If you read a Lee Child's book, which is why people follow authors, because that's again part of the reader contract. I know what I'm going to get.
Yes, they get the satisfaction. I enjoyed that book. I'm going to read everything he or she has written, because I'm going to get the same pleasure again and again.
And then other authors will choose a different name to write in different genres.
Yes.
So Ian Banks, and J.K. Rowling, Robert Galbraith.
I think that's why I'm feeling so disillusioned with Brienne, because it's coming out like a young adult adventure for me.
Well, that's okay. And there are some fabulous books in the young adult.
No, I totally enjoy reading many of them as well, but I don't seem to be able to make it nasty enough. I've been trying, believe me.
Well, maybe you are coming at it from the wrong direction then. Maybe you are trying to make it fit instead of just writing a great story and then thinking.
I want to be a sci-fi writer. I don't want to be a young adult writer.
Being a successful writer. But you know,
I'm just finishing something. That'd be good.
I was just very sorry that you stopped with Brienne. I like that story very much. I really was enjoying
it. Perhaps it just needs some, what's that word called, would it? Fermentation.
Percolation. Maturation.
But perhaps in the
marination.
Perhaps in the meantime, I'll go off and I'll write the political thriller that's occurred to me.
Well, this is what Teresa's been doing for years, is writing plays and writing short stories and writing bits of novels. And now, with how many chapters in?
Oh, 12.
Only 12, but it's flowing. Because it's a children's novel, I may be halfway through, which is pretty amazing for me. Yeah. I'm amazed. Yeah, and I still, you know, I'm going to finish it.
You're still motivated.
It's really great. I think it could be a series. Because that age group really likes series, and they buy everything in a series.
They may not be able to wait 3 years for the next episode. that's the problem. But I think, I mean, just taking that point, which is changing the subject slightly, a lot of people take a lot of time over their first novel, and then somehow they manage to produce one a year. And I guess you just get better at it, but also then you start to be more disciplined, hopefully, and you can see the advantages of actually sitting down and doing an hour every day.
We're looking at that R.L. Stein guy that wrote Goosebumps. Hundreds of books he's written for children.
Hundreds.
Literally 300 and odd.
They're short books, aren't they? But he was, I should say that we watched some sort of masterclass videos.
Yeah.
And he was very inspiring. Mm. He was really just great to listen to and to take some tips from.
He was.
But you see, there again, young adult books, children's books, science fiction, action adventure. You can have historical fiction for young adults. I mean, there's so many different ways to slice it, aren't there?
I saw I don't know if this was a category or a genre, but called new adult. And it was for basically people in their early 20s and
mid-20s.
New adult. And I hadn't heard that before.
No, I haven't heard of that one. People who don't want to grow up.
So complicated, isn't it?
Yeah.
Childhood is just extending and extending. It's up to about 40 now, isn't it?
So to summarise then, you're finding knowing that it's coming of age and having conventions useful.
Yes, it's very useful to me, and I have an idea plotted about having, you know, the disillusionment and the middle build and finding, you know, all of the things that are going on other than just beginning and end, and it's been very, very, very good for me.
It's been helpful to know the kind of things that need to happen along the way. And for Nicola, it's kind of distracted you a bit.
Well, yeah, but it started out being good because I could plot the whole thing, but then I'm finding the actual writing I'm not so bothered, but you know,
not as much fun as you thought.
No, no. But then, you know, nobody said it would be easy, did they? And
if it was easy, we'd all be very established, successful, published authors. So what's your favourite genre then, Pat?
Probably crime. I think.
Cozy crime?
No, not really.
Hard-boiled crime.
Well, I mean, I suppose I started with Agatha Christie and Dorothy L. Sayers, Mary Marsh, all those people. Yeah. When I was sort of researching cozy crime, and I looked at the titles and authors that they were including in the category, I was thinking, ooh. Turned my nose up a little bit. Yeah. And certainly not the sort of Midsummer Murders.
I started with all those, but then I was always drawn to the darker elements in the characters, especially the detectives, when the detectives had flaws.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's another convention of a crime, that kind of crime.
Absolutely.
Very much the sort of
flawed detective, definitely.
And I really got into it when I was introduced to what were at the time the new sort of breed of sort of women crime writers, like Mal McDermott, Sue Grafton, Sarah Paratsky and people like that.
Mm-hmm. So we know that Nicola's favourite genre is science fiction.
Yes.
Yep.
And that's...
And followed hotly by crime.
Okay, followed hotly by crime. What's your favourite genre?
Now, what genre would it be? I like a lot of humour. I just finished a book that I really enjoyed called The Overdue Life of Amy Bylerin. And it was very humorous. But it was also, there was a story in here about a woman who struggled because her husband left and finding a kind of a new life. And
I think that kind of serious humorous, like, you know, Eleanor Oliphant, serious message told with humour, and what you're doing with Mary Magdalene fits in very well. I don't know what kind of genre you'd call that.
What is Eleanor Oliphant? I love that
book. It's called Uplit, is the new genre. Yeah, Uplit.
Uplifting
literature. Yeah. So it's about addressing serious issues, but it's using humour. And there is redemption at the end. So again, it's a slice of a lot of the sort of more traditional genres. But this Uplit is supposed to be uplifting.
Okay. And there again, you see some writers create a new genre. Mm. Uh-huh. Okay. So they do something and it is massively imitated. Mm. So, I mean, in terms of cozy crime, I know you gave some earlier examples, but that term I don't think was around when they were writing. No. And I think perhaps Alexander McCall Smith with the Number One Ladies Detective Agency perhaps almost invented that that kind of
thing. Okay.
And how about you, Heather? What's your...
I think my favourite is fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
I quite like reading things that are... haven't happened and possibly never could happen, and work different worlds, you know, people that, and because I so admire people that can picture that in their head,
so
Tolkien, you know, sort of to be able to write all of those words about a society that doesn't exist and, you know, inventing different breeds of people. Yeah. It's just amazing.
It
is. And you've got to in the mind of the writer, he has to know that world inside out, and it has to have internal consistency and logic
that's the great thing, isn't it?
I find every time I read a book like that or get to go to look to how it's written, I find that there's actually barely any description at all. So the elements of good writing and world building seem to be that you give just enough for the reader to be able to picture it in their head.
Well, the reader
got to know this perfectly so that you kind of just know that they know.
And even if as a reader you paint it in your mind differently, it doesn't matter. They have to have that confidence in the world.
Nicola, I'm a little confused now, because in your the novel you first began with Brienne, you said that these things need to be within the realm of what's possible now.
Well, that's why it slipped into supernatural, you see, because it went into an afterlife.
Fiction,
because I was going to say, you have all of these beings that are like protoplasm and other things.
I was trying to do a sci-fi book and it turned into a supernatural action adventure.
Well, you could invent the whole...
With a redemption twist.
And a bit of a coming of age.
If you continue writing, just let it go and then find out later what you really think. Where does it fit?
You might be inventing
because
a whole new
I know. That's what I was thinking.
And the thing is, that, you know, I can't write anymore because I need to put the conventional scenes in, don't I? Because I'll get all the wrong conventional scenes in and then my reader will be unsatisfied.
Well, if that's how you feel, then you shouldn't carry on with it. But I think a lot of people have written books...
Not knowing any of these things, and they've been
fine. And sometimes it must surely be a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. It's post-rationalisation.
So
you write it and then you post-rationalise it and fit it into books.
Yeah.
I could pitch Lacking Grace as women's fiction. I could call it Uplit. I could call it issue-led fiction, you know, book club fiction.
Historical Uplit.
I mean, there's so many ways of doing it.
Like, yeah.
Right, so now Linda and Teresa are going to tell us what's on their bedside table. Linda, can we come to you first?
You certainly may. I've been reading Paisley Shirt by Gail Alwyn. And it's my first real foray into flash fiction. And I've just never thought I would enjoy something that just goes so fast, 500 words or so, and some seem to be less than that. But Paisley Shirt is like, it has 27 flash fiction stories. And I find it fascinating now to see how a complete and thoughtful story can be conveyed in so few words. And so it goes quickly, very quickly, reading it. But I've discovered, too, you need to slow down when you're reading it. Right. Don't just sit there and turn one page after another, but let some of this just rest and percolate, as we say. And I don't know, we used to talk about how to write the fast bit slow and the slow bits fast. And I'm not sure how that applies to the reading.
Read the slow bits.
Yeah. But I think it is important to just kind of, with flash fiction, give it a few minutes or a day before you continue to the next one.
Yes, so it can settle in.
It needs a little more time. So if you choose to read it, and I certainly recommend it, then take your time, savor every little brief look into life on your own. It's really, really good. Wow. I love Paisley Shirt. Gail Aldwin.
She'll be very pleased to hear it. We interviewed her a month or so ago, didn't we?
Yeah.
Excellent.
Right. Teresa.
Well, Stephanie, you're going to be bored of hearing about this, but I have just finished reading a wonderful non-fiction book, The Wicked Boy by Kate Summerscale. This is just a superbly researched book. And through her research, she gives you start to build up the texture of everyday life for the late Victorian working classes. This is just as a byproduct, but it's the story of a murder. And it's the story of two boys who have apparently murdered their mother. And she investigates this story, and she investigates the behaviour of the boys and what happened afterwards. The first section of the book concerns the crime, what the boys were doing in the days surrounding the crime and after the crime. And they went to Lord's and saw W.G. Grace play cricket. They went to the theatre. They went to the seaside. Things going on in the background. There was a by-election going on in East Ham at the time, and Keir Hardie was a candidate. So all that fascinating detail I love, and it's a very intriguing story. The second part was just the most astonishing insight into the conditions and regime in Broadmoor in the late Victorian and Edwardian period. And that's fascinating. And then in the end, you know, the third section and the book as a whole, it just is the most astounding biography. And I won't tell you any more than that. But, you know, basically my brother and I were reading it at the same time, so I had to buy him a copy so that I could get my copy back. My daughter's read it, and I'm giving it to everybody and recommending it to everybody. I think it's absolutely brilliant, fascinating, intriguing, and will change your view about some aspects of late Victorian society, perhaps.
Would you tell us the name once more?
The Wicked Boy by Kate Summerscale, who she also wrote
Mr. Witcher.
The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher and Mrs. Robinson's Disgrace is another of hers that I've read.
Right, thank you for that. Well, that's nearly over for another week. Now, I noticed we've got a couple of listeners in the Maldives.
No.
So if it's you, perhaps you could interrupt the stream of pictures of white sandy beaches on your Facebook feed to tell your friends about Write Club the podcast. It's very easy to share on Facebook or Twitter. And don't forget to tell your podcast provider how much you like us by leaving a 5-star review. And please come back next week. We'll see you then. Until then.
Bye.